May I please inquire? I'd like to reserve 10 minutes, Your Honor.
Reserve 10 minutes?
Yes.
Yes, sir.
I don't have much to say.
But okay, that's fine. That's good.
Your Honor, my name is James Zilovich. I'm representing Ms. Leslie Camp on appeal from the Circuit Court of Fredericksburg. If I could, I probably should have brought the counsel who argued the Coomer case, perhaps, because it seems like a lot of the issues that were dealt in that case are exactly what we're dealing with today.
Effectively, if I understand your argument, really the only issue is whether the evidence was sufficient to show a probability of harm.
Yes, I think if you narrow it down to one sentence, that's exactly where we get. And frankly, that's exactly where we get with most of these types of cases. Not only the driving aspect of neglect or abuse, but also all of these cases have always come down to, in court, we as defense attorneys, we come with a big thick file full of cases. The Commonwealth comes with their thick file because almost inevitably we get to the motion to strike and say these very particular facts, these particular case, do they fall on our side or do they fall on the Commonwealth's side? In other words, did the actions themselves create the probability of serious risk of bodily harm?
Do you agree with the basic concept that driving drunk increases the risk of injury to the driver and the passengers, at least marginally?
If you say the slightest margin, sure. I mean, there is some increase, yes.
Do you also agree that the drunker you get, at least marginally, that increases the risk?
In as much as the physiological effect on the individual, yes. But I would also argue that the BAC component may not be an accurate representation of that. I don't think too many of us have to go into the war stories or what we know from our own trial experiences about people's relative tolerances to alcohol. And probably all of us have at least seen one person at a very high level of intoxication who, when you see them on a video camera, are standing stock still, hand out, because they've developed a tolerance, frankly, they're probably alcoholics.
Although in this case, we had two flat tires from hitting a curb and a near miss with the officer's car.
We did, and the judge raised, I'm sorry.
Was Officer Lasko's police cruiser marked?
I do not know.
Okay.
Sorry. But I would say that Ms. Camp responded to being pulled, responded to the officer and the cruiser. He actually followed her into her own subdivision. She pulled over. There was no incident noted about how she parked. She parked, I guess, in the lines or not. It didn't come up that she didn't.
Although then we shortly thereafter have some incidents that indicate, at the very least, a lack of control and judgment through the visit to Mary Washington Hospital.
Well, and I guess I was going to address that, and because it is something that was referred to at trial, and I guess the judge did consider it. But I guess where does the line start and stop? I mean, if we're going to consider her behavior when operating the motor vehicle as the act itself that may lead to a finding that she was operating in an extremely dangerous manner or with a reckless disregard, then don't you stop there? I mean, if she's taking her kids bicycling without helmets 2 days later, that obviously could be considered dangerous conduct also.
Well, to some extent, though, doesn't it color where her state of mind was in the time, given that she is, given the testimony, likely drunker when she's driving the car than when she's at the hospital and blows has .25 drawn, not blown?
I think it's something the court could consider, but obviously if she'd been doing that from the outset with the officer, had gotten out of her car, fallen out of her car, say, begun to scream obscenities to the officer, making sexual commentary, then I think then you take it in the moment. But what we did here is she's answering questions. She said she didn't know her tires were flat, but she said she did hit a curb, so she was aware of her circumstances.
Does that in itself cause a problem, that she doesn't understand that there is a defect to the vehicle that she's driving, that her tires are flat?
I don't know.
Arguably, that is going to cause an impact on one's ability to actually properly control the vehicle, isn't it?
Well, if you hit a curb, then just because you hit a curb doesn't necessarily mean that your tire goes flat, number one.
But there are two flat tires of which she's unaware in attempting to maneuver a vehicle.
Correct. But the officer said she was able to maneuver a vehicle.
But almost to the point where she almost struck his vehicle.
But didn't. I mean, there's the evidence. There's no evidence. And honestly, if she even struck the vehicle, I would go back to, we're going to have to make a decision, I suppose, about whether the fact of an accident, then do we gauge the severity of the accident, or is it de minimis, like in the Coomer case, to make a determination about that?
Is there a distinction, though, between the accident, the first accident, and potentially operating a vehicle that might be dangerous because of its condition?
I would say without more evidence, no, because again, you know, people have flat tires all the time. They have to maneuver to a place to change the tire.
Is it your understanding of the record that she never acknowledges knowing that the tires are flat, or that she initially...
She did not know initially that the tires were flat.
And so she doesn't... Is it your position that the record reflects that she doesn't realize the tires are flat until she's in the parking lot with the officer?
That would be our position. Okay. And because, and again, I think that that knowledge would have some of, I guess, some basis for what you're asking about, I guess, the general condition of the vehicle. But I would say, you know, absent the ability, I would say it would be a little bit different than something that's apparently obvious, like the windshield smashed out or something like that, where it's literally right in front of her face and she may have to acknowledge the circumstance.
The car kind of be doing this?
It could be.
You've referenced Coomer, but of course that's not the only time we've kind of addressed willful and wanton and reckless disregard for human life in the alcohol driving context. But the Supreme Court in Stevens and this court in Wood have said when you get up above, you know, three times, and in this case the evidence light most favorable to the Commonwealth is more than three times the legal limit, that in and of itself is enough. One, is that binding on us, and two, if it's not, why is it wrong?
Well, I don't need to have this pop from my own head. I could literally pull out the Coomer case where the court said that basically the reliance on Stevens result is reliance on dicta. In other words, that the very fact of intoxication itself is not dispositive. And even that court, the Stevens court, considered other factors. Like in that case...
But specifically said it was sufficient, and hence the Coomer characterization of it as dicta. But given that Coomer wasn't dealing with anything near this level of intoxication that was present in Stevens, that's present here, that's present in Wood, isn't Coomer's statement that those statements in Stevens and Wood are dicta, isn't it dicta that's not binding?
Not necessarily, because I think it goes more to the holding of the particular case, which is that there were other circumstances to look at. And in that case, in Coomer specifically, yes, she was intoxicated. Yes, she did strike a vehicle, though they said not very hard. But then they said that now. Then there's a breakdown, though, about you know, there is a 18.2270. There's a DUI with an augmented punishment for having children in the vehicle, which obviously doesn't rise to the level of the gross, wanton, negligent conduct that could lead to the loss of human life. There's not a homicide in that case, but in Stevens, where there is a death by motor vehicle, they even break down the statute, and I think it's broken down again in Coomer, where it talks about the normal DUI death, if you will, is prosecuted one way. But again, if you have that extreme conduct, it's prosecuted another. So it seems to pull apart the fact of an intoxication from the extreme intoxication.
Well, right. And so the extreme intoxication is 2 to 3 times, which wasn't present in Coomer but is present here. That's the holding of Stevens. Or at least a statement in Stevens, whether it's holding or dicta.
Yeah, I'll reserve 5 minutes if that's right. I guess I can just finish.
Whatever time is left will be yours.
Thank you. I don't disagree with that, but the problem is then this case is not quite the judge just saying he's relying on the BAC alone, because he does mention the fact of an accident. He mentions what he calls extreme intoxication, and then he also mentions. He also mentions that she failed her FSTs. Well, frankly, it's kind of a wash, I think, because that could happen with any DUI or someone that's a 0.08 or a 0.12 or 1.5 or whatever. The problem with this idea of extreme intoxication, I was trying to address that earlier, and if I didn't do it artfully, I apologize. But, I mean, where's the number? If we're going to rely on extreme intoxication, is 3 times as we have in this case, is that the number we say is de facto by itself a factor that the trial court could say that alone is all I need? Is it 2 times the limit? So what, a 0.16? There is no number, obviously, but obviously I would think that this court's patience with the finder of fact would decrease with the BAC as a fact by itself. So as I read Coomer, what they weren't trying to do is negate necessarily the idea that extreme intoxication is it. But I think, I can't remember if it was specifically in the Coomer case, but there's a discussion in the Riley case, which is another death case, but there's a discussion about it is certainly a factor for consideration. And in Stevens itself, there's the idea that Stevens, you know, yes, there's an accident. Yes, there's he runs a red light. He doesn't remember the accident. He has a very difficult time, you know, dealing with things. He's confused.
Given Dr. O'Neill's testimony about the effects of the blood alcohol level that we have here, what is irrational about a fact finder learning that blood alcohol content and hearing that testimony and going, the risk of injury to the children is now probable.
Because even Dr. O'Neill or any of the doctors that come testify, Dr. Saadi used to come, I mean, those doctors have to always couch, they can speak in generalities to mankind and womankind as a whole, but they always have to couch their opinion in terms of not only the static things like height and weight, but also the things that are not static. How much sleep has the person had? Are they taking other medications? Did they eat? How much did they eat? How far back did they drink? How quickly did they drink? I mean, all of those things come into play. And then, of course, they're coupled with the individual's physiological component. And, you know, I'm certainly not qualified to stand here and testify as a scientist, but those are factors. And when the expert themselves says that they have to make that consideration, then give the general opinion about how it affects the specific person they're testifying about, it would seem like the finder of fact has to accept the opinion as it's given to them, which would include sort of dealing with the generality of it, but then look for other information to conclude that the conduct has risen to the level required by the statute. May I reserve the rest of the time if that's okay?
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Mr. Jones?
Good morning, and may it please the court. I am John Jones for the Commonwealth, and we are asking the court to affirm Ms. Camp's convictions because the evidence was sufficient to support the trial court in making the finding that it did with regard to her criminal negligence. So the evidence supported a rational fact finder in concluding that she acted with reckless disregard for the lives of her children. First off, Camp makes the point and tries to characterize this as a mere intoxication case and says that under Coomer that's not enough. But even if this was a mere intoxication case, I think the court's already alluded to the difference in the level of intoxication between what there was in Coomer, where she was 0.10 to 0.11.
In the Commonwealth's mind, can Coomer and Wood be reconciled simply on the level of intoxication?
I think so, Your Honor. And I think that Coomer specifically says that if you look toward the top of page 547, in the Virginia Appellate Reporter, the court says that the issue of whether the evidence supports a finding of criminal negligence as a matter of law must necessarily turn solely on whether Coomer's degree of intoxication standing alone is sufficient to establish the element of criminal negligence. So distilled, that was the issue in Coomer, according to the court in Coomer. So if Coomer turned on Coomer's level of intoxication, and here we have a level of intoxication that's nearly three times as high as that, I think that's the way that you can read Coomer and Wood coexisting, and Stevens as well. And I think that where you have a level of intoxication here that is right in line with the levels of intoxication in Wood and Stevens, and whether that was dicta or
Do you want to speak to that, though? Because Coomer does indicate that the holding, or I won't say holding, but that some of the comments in Stevens are in fact dicta, and how does that impact what we do here today?
I don't think that this court is bound by the Coomer opinions terming the language in Wood and Stevens as dicta to the extent that it can't consider those holdings in Stevens and in Wood. And I think maybe the best way to deal with that is to, even if the court says that is dicta, that doesn't mean it's not persuasive in Wood and Stevens.
Well, and given the difference in intoxication levels between Coomer and the other two cases, was the statement that the other two cases, the statement in Coomer regarding the other cases containing dicta, was it necessary to the resolution of Coomer?
I don't think so, Your Honor.
Which would render it what?
Dicta. So I do not think that aspect of the Coomer opinion binds this court. So, but more to, I think, the ultimate point in this case, this is not a mere intoxication case. We have extreme intoxication in addition to several instances of dangerous behavior that resulted from Camp driving with her children in the car. You have her driving into the wrong lane and almost hitting Lasco's marked cruiser.
Is it a marked cruiser?
It is a marked cruiser. On page 174 of the appendix, it points out Lasco testifies that he was in his marked cruiser. And the fact that she did hit the median and then drive home on two flat tires, and I think the court's pointed that out, and to the extent that Camp tries to term that as being perhaps a necessary step or a reasonable step that she took, That depends on an interpretation of evidence that ignores the standard of review, which is that the evidence is viewed in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth. And viewed in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth, those were not reasonable actions. Those were not necessary. They were unexplained, negligent actions that greatly increased the danger to her children. And additionally, I hadn't considered the Lasko's testimony to be even capable of interpreting as that she didn't know about the flat tires until she got into the parking lot. But even if we accepted that contention, and so the evidence did support that, that doesn't help her, because as the court has already alluded to, a person would presumably know if they're driving around on two flat tires, because the car is going to behave very differently, and it does affect control. I don't know that's a fact in evidence, but it I think that under that interpretation of the evidence, that it doesn't really help her. It doesn't make her conduct less reckless. And again, I would just point out the additional factors that pointed toward her extreme level of intoxication, because that does go into the analysis. The level of her intoxication plus the other factors is the totality of evidence supporting the trial court's finding that she acted with reckless disregard by, in that state of intoxication, deciding to drive her kids home. She had the elevated BAC, the impressive failure on the sobriety test. This wasn't just a technical failure. She fell down as soon as she took her one leg off of the ground for the one leg stand test. She just kept walking on the walk and turn test until Officer Lasko stopped her, and she took the wrong kind of steps. And and then her erratic and belligerent behavior, both when Lasko first approached her in the parking lot, she was ignoring him and then started acting evasive, and he had a hard time getting her to stand still. And then when the decision was made to bring her to the hospital, undressing, casting very rude.
We've read it.
Yeah. And so I think that just viewed in the totality, the evidence does support a rational fact finder in finding that she acted with criminal negligence. And so if there are no additional questions, I would just ask the court to affirm.
Okay, well, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Ilovich.
You can't find within just a couple of words of any of these decisions what the finder of fact has to rely on, obviously. But what all of them seem to refer to, and with good reason, is because there is no individual factor that should be dispositive to a finding of this type. And that's why I think in Coomer, at least, they went back and said, yes, it is a factor, even mentioned cases where they said it was a factor, but not the factor. And the factor that the trial court had to consider in this case, and what you have to consider about what the reasonable trier of fact heard, was, yes, he heard about an accident. Yes, he heard about what they call extreme intoxication. The judge, that's the term he used. But what it is actually is an extreme BAC or an elevated BAC. And again, you have to look then past that to make a determination about is it indicative of intoxication? Almost certainly. But is indicative of extreme intoxication necessary to reach the standard that creates her conduct, which then would fall under the level that's required by the statute? She does, yes, she falls down on a one-legged stand, but frankly, if you read through the description of her BAC, that's not a whole lot different than what police officers testify to in a lot of DUIs. They have trouble with the DUIs. There's the physical component, of course, but there's the rule-following component, too. And if people can't do the test, then that's a factor because physically they may be unable to because they're, frankly, impaired, or they can't follow directions because they're, well, frankly, impaired. So that's just a factor of being under the influence. But she wasn't confused. She wasn't non-responsive. She wasn't...
Does the fact that she apparently lied to the officer play into this one way or the other?
Can I say no comment?
No. Well, you can say it.
Is it something the court heard? Yes. But I don't know. One would argue that having guile would probably mean that you're more plugged into the situation than that.
I wondered if you'd go there. It's a good argument.
You asked. So that's what the court had to consider. And so as the courts have had to consider this issue in both the cases where there's just simply the DUI and then the cases where there's the DUI in addition to, you know, sadly, loss of life, they still have to step back and look at the act of the DUI itself. And the Rich case comes to mind. That's one where the lady who was driving under the influence hits a guy on a little scooter in an intersection. And as bad as it could be, it sounds, you know, but her behavior was merely driving under the influence. So that conduct by itself didn't rise to the level.
But granted, it's 18.236.1. A and B, because you have to read them together at issue in Stevens. But the Supreme Court in Stevens specifically says that the level of intoxication alone, and the only reference to a level of intoxication in the opinion is, in fact, the BAC level. And I understand what your arguments regarding that, but that's what they're referring to. Said, we got all this other stuff, but they specifically say that alone is enough to meet this statutory standard, and the language is identical.
Yet even
given that that is the Virginia Supreme Court, and we don't have Supreme in our name, why isn't that dispositive?
Because even within that opinion, period, they go on to talk about other things with that defendant. And I think if they'd simply ended it there, you may be able to infer that just the BAC alone would be indicative, but they had to talk about the defendant talked about the conduct of the defendant.
They did talk about it, but they specifically said, this factor alone is sufficient, period. We have other stuff. But they did say that factor alone was sufficient. If we give credit to that statement, how can we rule in your favor?
Because I think in policy-wise, it would be very difficult then are we taking up next year a 0.18 with no other circumstances and trying to make a decision, well, if it was a 1.6 or a 1.9, that perhaps we'd rule otherwise. The only way you can, I guess, kind of take the conduct of the defendant and even have the finder of fact wrap it into conduct that's necessary for the code is to not just look at that fact, but then look at everything surrounding it and try to make a determination if it's rise to the level that's necessary.
Very well. Thank you. We will step down and greet counsel and thereafter take up the writ of actual innocence in the Fuchs case.